When I say Black history, what comes to mind for you? For many of us, we think about oppression, a continuous struggle for security, rights, equality. But a new PBS series focuses on the far more vast richness of Black life in American history. It's called Making Black America Through the Grapevine. Here's the trailer.
Black Americans created a world on the other side of the color line, a world behind the veil.
Black people create spaces where we can be seen by each other. Sometimes you just want to celebrate how dope it is to be black.
And we're going to talk about what's behind the veil, schools, barbershops, underworlds, entrepreneurs behind the veil. With the host of the series, Henry Louis Gates Jr. directs the Hutchins Center for African and African American Studies at Harvard. Professor Gates, welcome.
Thanks. Good afternoon. I hope you're having a good day.
I'm well. Professor Gates, you say the term behind the veil many times in this four-hour series. It was coined by the author and activist W.E.B. Du Bois. What does it mean in this context?
When the color curtain came crashing down with the rise of white supremacy following the rollback to Reconstruction, Du Bois coined this metaphor of life behind the veil of race, so that all African Americans had a double existence, a double identity as citizens in the broader society, but then our identity at home, behind the veil of color, within that segregated world. And the curious thing is, if you look at a lot of Hollywood movies or a lot of representations of Black history and popular culture, you think all our ancestors did was sit around and talk about white people, white racism, white supremacy, and figure out how to defeat it, that we were engaged in one constant civil rights struggle 24 hours a day. But nobody can be at war 24 hours a day.
Yeah, well, as your series tells, you need music, you need joy, you need food, and your series really focuses on you need networks, institutions, networks of Black people.
We ask the fundamental question, what did Black people do when the color curtain came crashing down? And the answer is that they replicated as best they could the larger white world from which they had been excluded. And while fighting back as fiercely as they could politically, they simultaneously replicated that other world in their own image, inventing an astonishing array of artistic forms and social networks, both secular and sacred, including church guilds, fraternities, sororities, and all manner of secret societies.
Yeah. And yeah. Well, as I hear you say that, you know, I think about in Chinese, they say all the time, you need people. You need networks of people. And you tell the story of churches, literary societies, centers of political debate, you know, back in the 19th century. And then when they're needed, say in the Underground Railroad, right, some of these institutions jump into action because they had been seeded, you know, through the generations. And I want to ask you to tell us about kind of one person. As a longtime business reporter in the past, I love the focus on entrepreneurs, notably Black women entrepreneurs in the 19th century. The series goes into the beauty entrepreneur, C.J. Walker, the goddess of Harlem, salon events, Alelia Walker. But can you tell us about the first woman to own a bank in the United States?
Well, she's one of my heroes, Maggie Lena Walker. Built the Independent Order of St. Luke. That was one of the many fraternities and sororities that Black people created. And Maggie Lena Walker transformed that into a financial institution that was unprecedented, the St. Luke Penny Savings Bank. And it was largely financed and run not only by Black people, but by Black women. And that's one of the things I'm most gratified about the series, that I hope that we restore the agency that African-American women exhibited along with African-American men. And that's one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is the Atlanta washerwomen strike in 1881. These are anonymous working class women. They were washing the sheets and laundry for wealthy white people in Atlanta. And these women mobilized, demanded higher wages, city officials buckled, and met some of the washerwomen's demands. And that set an example for other Black laborers to organize. And this is Black women, uneducated, who beat the system. And that's amazing.
And we have a clip we can play about this broader point about how black spaces, beauty parlors, notably black spaces run by African-American women and their importance. Let's take a listen.
What we really see when we look at the era of Jim Crow is that it became a place for black women to think and to plot and to plan for political purposes.
You know, Professor Gates, your story tells a long history, but there are patterns, moments when black Americans turn outward and start to integrate, whatever the word is, with the broader society, and other moments when they turn inward. One of those moments is the Great Depression. And yet in the middle of this, and there's the metaphor of this haven in a storm of thriving, creating magazines like Ebony and Jet, and the Green Book of black-owned businesses for African-American travelers from a man named Victor Green. Let's take a listen to a clip of that from your series.
When the Green Book came into publication, there were about 70,000 black-owned businesses throughout America. It had everything from liquor stores, nightclubs, funeral homes, doctors, haberdashers, milliners, anything you could think of that you might need on the road.
Part of the story this series lays out is a pattern of thriving and joy, accomplishment, and then pushback from the broader society. Do you see it that way, that there is a has been a continuous push and push backward?
Yeah, two steps forward, one step back. Look at the Tulsa riots in the Black Wall Street, 1921. Black people are so successful, so prosperous. And what happens? In 24 hours, the whole neighborhood is destroyed because of economic competition. And the fact is, one of the leitmotifs in this series and in all my work is that racism is really a function of deeper, darker forces of economic competition. When Black people become an economic threat in terms of the accrual power, whether it's political power in Reconstruction or economic power, as we saw in Tulsa, what happens? There is a pushback. One of the first examples was in Cincinnati in 1829. Cincinnati's Black population skyrocketed during the 1820s. White people in Cincinnati, ostensibly liberal, viewed these African Americans as competitors who took their jobs and drove down wages. So white city leaders turned to Ohio's decades-old Black laws to assert their control. And Black people protested. And on August 15th of that year, the mob stormed the city's Black district known as Bucktown for 3 days. And that gave rise to the first civil rights movement, which is the Colored Convention movement, which began in direct response to this race riot in Cincinnati generated by the threat of Black economic competition. And look, you don't have to go back 200 years. Look at the reaction to the election of the first Black president. There's no question that a great deal of the enmity and animosity toward Obama, toward Democrats, and the rise of Donald Trump was a direct result of white supremacist reaction to the election, even of a person as amazing and as perfect for the part as Barack Obama and his splendid, lovely, brilliant wife and family.
Well, I want to ask you briefly about where we are today. We see books being banned from libraries. We see school districts saying certain chapters in history cannot be told under the banner of critical race theory. It is a form of historical erasure. And yet at this moment, your series is coming out on PBS, and I wonder if the timing in your view is that it needs to come out now.
The subtext of our series is this, that the most important political act of all for Black people fighting anti-Black racism and white supremacy was creating a culture in their own image, refusing to allow white racists to define who we are, reacting against the representation of Black social institutions as if they're pathological, as somehow substandard, and they weren't at all. Without those networks, we never would have been able to engage in the abolitionist movement. We never would have been able to form the civil rights movement and fight lynching. We never would have been able to embark on the modern civil rights movement, starting with Rosa Parks, Dr. King, and the Montgomery bus boycott, and culminating in the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65. It was within the Black community, within the veil, that we restore, that we establish and share our self-esteem and bolster ourselves to fight, to make things better for another day. And that is the world that I'm celebrating.
Henry Louis Gates Jr. is executive producer and host of Making Black America Through the Grapevine. It's a four-part documentary series on PBS, and it begins tonight. Henry Louis Gates, so good to have you. Thanks for the time.
Thank you for the honor and pleasure.